Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Lake Tahoe, serene, gorgeous, peaceful, and at times pricey. Anyone who has been knows that visiting for even a day or two can cost you a pretty penny, depending on where you go and where you stay, of course. And for many lifelong residents, calling Tahoe home full-time has become financially unsustainable, especially recently. Coming up in a few minutes, how the pandemic is displacing people who have made towns like Truckee their home, and why property owners are calling up their tenants and giving them notice to find another place. But first, Merced County, finally out of the purple tier, the last of California's 58 counties to move out of that dreaded purple. Yesterday, the news that county health officials, leaders, business owners have been waiting for. California's health department moving Merced to red, meaning businesses can loosen restrictions and life can start to resemble the rest of the state. Merced County's lengthy stay in the purple tier has not been without controversy. One county supervisor quoted as saying the county should have been moved to red more than 2 weeks ago. In the meantime, businesses continue to struggle as the county fought the state to get the numbers right. Yesterday, just hours after that announcement was made, I spoke with Merced County's public health director, Dr. Rebecca Nanyanjo-Kemp. And I started off by asking her why it took Merced County this long to advance to looser restrictions.
Well, that's a great question. I think with the rate that things were going in or the timeline that it was taking for things to materialize, we fared a bit differently from the rest of the remaining counties. We had one of the lowest allocations on several weeks in a row, the lowest allocation by rate per capita in the state. And also there was also an issue of data that occurred during one of the earlier weeks, which is why we had submitted an adjudication request for consideration. And what had happened, and this happened throughout the state, but there was a large amount of data that was transferred to different jurisdictions. This was one lab in particular, and that ended up increasing our absolute case count, which then impacted our case rate. When they took the numbers for that week, they compared it against a week where none of those cases that we received on one day were applied to the correct days for the previous data run. And so that created a huge difference in our case rates for our current versus our former case rate, which is why we had been advised that we were going to be remaining in purple as of last week. And that's where we got the process started with an adjudication or, you know, having some sort of intervention, so to speak. And that once they reviewed it, they did agree with it. But then the subsequent conversation to that is, we'll make the timeline applicable to when it took place. Don't hold us to what's taking place this week for an event that took place last week. And so I do think there was an opportunity for clarity with the state in looking at our numbers as validly as we do within the county and taking the emotion out of it and keeping it objective. I also do understand the situation the state is in. You know, they're trying to keep things consistent and as objective as possible for 58 local health jurisdictions. That's quite a few to have to keep track of. So I'm glad we were able to come to a resolution where we were in the category, to be honest, we should have been in last week, the tier assignment.
And that really brings up another point. I just spoke with Inyo County on Tuesday, and they expressed similar concerns and frustrations that the metrics didn't necessarily apply to their county fairly. Every county is very unique. Would you say that the same was similar for Merced County, given that both of you were the two remaining counties in the purple tier?
So I can't fully speak to what took place with Inyo County. What I can say is that the way data, as I understand it, should have been assessed was very different from how the assessment was conducted. You know, I don't want to say whether it's fair or unfair because that's pretty subjective, but from the space of equity and just being a just way to look at it versus the way they advised us they would be looking at it, I can say there was inconsistency there. And so we became a bit more deliberate and assertive in our discussions because this was something that, as of last week, we did not want to deviate from. We knew what the numbers were. We ran and reran and reran and are happy to report that they did come back in our favor. Now, that aside, that situation aside, throughout the course of this event, and I think this speaks to local health jurisdictions and their interaction, especially in decentralized states where the state is not like necessarily We follow their format. Every county health department in the state of California looks different because of that. But where you do have more centralized structures, like in the state of Florida and Ohio, where you have townships all reporting to the state, there's a lot more ease in getting consistency with the way things are executed. And with a state of 40 million people accounting for, you know, 12% of the population, consistency has been very, very difficult. I'm not sure that I'm glad the pandemic highlighted it, but for the duration that we've been in this, I don't think it's unfair to say that with good reason, state, local health jurisdictions should have, and moving forward, should expect a lot more than we received by way of the support that was necessary. Because again, I will agree with Inyo on this, we are organized very differently. The structure is very different. There's not a one size fits all approach. And it does seem the more you're in kind of those rural areas that are known socioeconomically a bit more poor and where there's a lot of considerations that may not look like the normal demographic in comparison to Oakland and San Francisco and LA and San Diego, there should be just as much consideration for those communities as they are for the big local health jurisdictions. And I found time and time again, this is not the first time where we've tried to bring up an issue. And I can understand, they're like, well, you know, we have to represent 40 million people, but we here in leadership at public health directors, public health officers, people who are in public health decision-making capacities, we have to represent our population. And yeah, I understand you represent and you have to speak for 40 million, but within those 40 million are my 300,000 residents, and I want consideration for them as well. And in the spirit of California's strategic plan for reopening being the blueprint for a safer economy, I do feel that that was a little reckless, very reckless, especially because we are already in a socioeconomically disenfranchised community. We know that there's issues of inequity that plague this community and throughout the San Joaquin Valley for that matter. And to be the only state remaining in the worst tier for a community that always hears, you should grow accustomed to the worst. And that has been the running theme throughout this pandemic. Totally unacceptable, completely unacceptable. And I think you can hear it with the change in the cadence of my voice. I always try and keep a cool head. I did not feel level-headed. I didn't feel I could be, because it was just so obvious. It's like, if we're always looking at the way you look at it. And I'll repeat to you what I've told other outlets as well, is our job as a local health jurisdiction is to amplify the expectation and the messaging that comes from the state. But when it's messaging that's inconsistent and does not take into consideration, especially when you come back with factual information, that's when you do have to advocate on behalf of the constituents you represent. And that's exactly what we did.
What kind of impact, being in the purple tier for this long, did it have on local leaders and business owners and residents in Merced County?
I would say from the qualitative perspective, there were aspects of goodwill and trust that had been lost, especially when you have a community where at the beginning, you know, we're still somewhat in a like less liberal area. I mean, we're still in the San Joaquin Valley here in Merced County. But, you know, when everything's going the right way, you're trying to maximize the few resources that you've been allocated. When everyone is kind of singing from the same hymn sheet and moving in the same direction, to be caught up on mistakes, you know, every little bit, especially after a period as long as we've been in COVID-19, people are feeling it. You see it throughout the state. You're seeing the ripple effects. You see these modes of vaccine nationalism, which I've never heard of, but we see it more and more pronounced, not just in the state or the nation, but throughout the world at this point. Those things make the narratives become more sensitive. Like, it's not just a no big deal. The community is not at that level yet, especially for the ones who've been consistently good players. I mean, it has broken my heart to know that we should have been in a less restrictive tier. And the ones who are always adhering to following the rules are like, no, we're not going to move outside of what the county allows for us to do. And yet we're restricted by what we're allowed to do by the state. So I would say there's been a bit of goodwill loss. I think in terms of relationships, just throughout the course of this pandemic, there is an opportunity to take a look at what partnership and collaboration really stand for, instead of just saying it. And especially when those are impactful words, the way it has been rolled out and doled out throughout the course of this, if equity, and I'm sure you've heard this mentioned several times, a cornerstone of how The state looks at items of consideration is through the lens of equity. So I guess I repose the question to you, is that equitable when, you know, there it's factually incorrect information, but who knows what we're going to do? You can't play games like that with the community that already feels that they're already at a loss. We got less vaccine. We've had higher death rates. We're always the lowest for this, worst fared in that. Where's the good news in this, especially when good news can be doled out? And so, yeah, I would say qualitatively more than metrically speaking, our job is to advocate and our job is to be honest. And when you're doing both and you still don't get the outcome that you are seeking or you are searching for, that is very disappointing. It's aggravating, it's frustrating, and it's very, especially in a time like this, some credibility you cannot get back. And we're hoping for the sake of our community that they understand we are here to represent them and the requirements and the best interests. And when we are hamstrung like that, it really also does a disservice to the overall academic spirit and discipline of public health.
In Merced County, I was just looking at the positivity rate. It's 4.4%, the 7-day average. That's a little over double the state's positivity rate. What are you seeing as a driving force behind the transmission rates in your county?
Well, I would say where we are now, positivity is really, it's largely dependent on accessibility to vaccine. And the goodwill that I mentioned having been somewhat lost just, you know, a moment ago when we spoke, I think also is applicable to the fact that we were the lowest capita recipient of vaccines for a period of time. I would dare say that may even be continuing now, but for several months, strung on end, we receiving the lowest number of vaccinations. We see the entire state opening. I mean, nobody's blind to that. People are traveling. People are tired of having the same holiday they missed last year be the same holiday they missed this year. If we are not able to get those rates up, there's a sweet spot in every communicable disease response, right? Especially when it's something acute, it's something highly infectious, highly communicable, where there was an opportunity where we had nothing but attention from the residents, which we yearned for quite a, and actually we have a great relationship, the health department, with the community. But here we are saying, hold on, just a moment. No, we're working with them. We're gonna see if we can get this. We're almost there. And you hear the same message for 8 to 10 weeks on end. Now that accessibility or availability is there, I don't think the community is as interested as they were when we told them we needed more, because we knew that it was only a matter of time before we were going to lose their attention. And just to keep it in perspective, when the initial allocations were being generated for each local health jurisdiction, Merced County is a 100% health provider shortage area. Merced County has some of the lowest rates in educational attainment throughout the state. Merced County, I mean, I believe you've heard the governor say it, and I heard it multiple times, in terms of the dependency that children and families have on the school system to ensure that there are meals provided that kids eat. You know, there's more than 90% of the community that depends on that service. And yet all of your allocation is dependent on, and we're a younger community here too, when it comes to average age and age groups here. But then to turn around and say, we're gonna base our allocation to each community on the number of providers they have available, on the amount of individuals or residents they have over the age of 65, it's like all of it worked to our disadvantage. There was a perfect storm for nothing going right. And it's felt like that for the last several months. We don't have the older population. It's a relatively young population. We don't have the number of providers. And to base decisions on measures of equity, where you know you're dealing with an inequitable situation, only exacerbates the worst. And it makes a bad situation that much more untenable.
You're in the county. Atwater will be the site of a new mass vaccination site. Do you think that's going to help curb or elevate the vaccination numbers, as this week eligibility increases to adults or people 16 years and older?
That's correct. We have had other vaccine sites through different things that became available to the community. I'm really hoping it does shift the course of where we see an uptick in people being more receptive to receiving the vaccine. again, we have a lot of work to do, even though everybody says there's light at the end of the tunnel. Unless you're standing right near me, I don't see it yet. So we have a metric or a percentage of 75 to 80 that we're trying to achieve. And not just with the rate and having all these sites available, there's also a willingness. This isn't a mandatory vaccine. This is not compulsory that you're required to get it. And we also, it's not the entire population we're looking at. You know, our under 16s are not eligible. And so I hope standing up these different facilities means more people getting vaccine or vaccinated. I don't think that when there's pauses or, you know, inquiries into the vaccines that are available, it helps with the public's trust. And so that's a consideration that we also have is, oh, now that, you know, how much declination or an increase in people declining the vaccine is going to be based on now this pause, which, as you may or may not recall, we had a pause on Moderna.
And you're discussing Johnson & Johnson, correct? When you're talking about pause?
Yes, I'm correcting. I am discussing the Johnson & Johnson and the pause that the state or the nation placed on it yesterday. But for in being in an already delicate situation, I guess time will tell how much resistance there is, because for those who don't have the time or the will for, you know, a two-shot series, which we understand can be inconvenient, several health departments and, you know, public health in general is depending on use of that single shot vaccination. And now that it's been called into question, I really hope that it doesn't disrupt the efforts that, you know, have already been successful, especially in a community such as ours, where it's largely rural, largely agricultural. We were really depending on that. And so time will tell. We're going to try and preempt it with some messaging, but we'd have to get a better idea of what the concerns are now throughout the community.
Finally, the state will reopen fully on June 15th if certain criteria are met. As a public health official, are you looking forward to June 15th at this point in time?
When I have more information, yes. But right now, reopening, what does that mean? Does that reopening means that we'll go down to yellow? It means everything is open and they're going to rely on pharmaceutical-based interventions like social distancing and masking. I think a lot remains to be seen. And unless our vaccine allocation goes up, as we've been really wanting to achieve and have asked the state numerous times for, unless that goes up, I think we're going to be left behind in something that's otherwise well-intentioned, because we've been left behind since December, and that's unfortunate. So time will tell. I hope if we were to speak a week or two from now when we had additional information, perhaps there would be reason for excitement. Right now, the only thing that we can do to keep ourselves headed in the right direction is move day by day. And that's what myself, our health officer, Dr. Sandoval, the leadership team here, that's what we're committed to doing, move day by day.
And that was Merced County's public health director, Dr. Rebecca Nanyanjo-Kemp. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. Up next, from the city to the mountains, why longtime residents of Truckee and Tahoe are struggling to find new housing as Bay Area landlords move in. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Want to visit Lake Tahoe for a few days? Well, finding a place, not usually a problem. Quick search of Airbnb will bring up dozens of homes and condos to rent. Of course, there are hotels and the home of a friend, right? But if you work in and around Tahoe and want to make your home there permanent but can't afford to buy, the long-term rental market is all but disappearing. And that's becoming a problem for a lot of people who are getting a call from their landlord asking them to be out of the house in 60 days. With so many people adapting to working from home, landlords are leaving the city behind behind in search of a more peaceful, less hectic lifestyle while still bringing in their Bay Area-sized salaries. Joining us to talk about this phenomenon is Julie Brown, a freelance journalist and contributing editor for SF Gate, where she covers Lake Tahoe. Julie is also a native of Truckee and now lives in Reno. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, Julie, I really appreciate your reporting. And you start off with social media posts about people needing to find a new place to live, locals in the Truckee and Tahoe area. Is this just anecdotal or is there actually data showing that there are an increase of people moving to Truckee and Tahoe?
Well, I think anecdotally, it's really apparent and obvious. I think almost every single day, local people are going to social media to plead for help, to help them find housing. It's really interesting that they're going to Facebook because there just aren't that many resources to help them find housing. Craigslist is impossible. But I think the hard numbers of what's happened to Tahoe and Truckee this year are still coming. I don't think we fully know how many people have come to the area. And also, you know, while there's certainly anecdotal stories, I mean, there's more traffic, there's more people, grocery stores are busier. It kind of remains to be seen what's going to happen after the pandemic and, you know, how many of these people are going to be staying here, you know, make a life in Tahoe, or how many are going to go back to the Bay.
Right. Well, we've all heard the term Zoomtown and associated with the Truckee area. Can you explain exactly what that means?
Yeah, it's been this like really interesting thing. I think that, I mean, Tahoe is such an incredible place and the demand for outdoor recreation has been growing and growing in recent years. And if you love to ski or love to hike or want to be outside, I mean, Truckee's kind of where it's at. But historically, you know, the job market in Truckee has been more limited. I mean, jobs up here are very tourism based. So that was kind of like put a limit on who could live here. The people who moved to Tahoe, I think it's like a very conscious decision for the lifestyle. They want to be here and they make sacrifices to be here. But when the pandemic happened and offices closed, suddenly people could work and live wherever they wanted. And I think it's not surprising at all that so many people from the Bay Area moved to Truckee and Tahoe when the pandemic started and their offices closed. And I know Tahoe's not the only place that's dealing with this. A lot of mountain towns across the West, across the country have been seeing a huge influx of new residents. But I think that Tahoe, with its proximity to San Francisco and Sacramento, it's the first stop. So it really took the brunt of that influx of people, I think.
You started off with the Brigham family in your reporting, and I think that's just such a telling story of one family when it comes to long-term renters in Truckee and Tahoe. Can you explain how families like the Brigham family are being impacted since they are long-term renters, have lived in the area for over a decade, and are now struggling to find a new place to live?
Yeah, I think the Brighams, I mean, they're just such a classic Tahoe family. You know, they moved here maybe like over 10 years ago. Rachel did. You know, I think that she just immediately fell in love with the place. A common story you hear in Tahoe is that people came here for one winter and they're here 30 years later. It's a place that just kind of sucks you in. And so, you know, they met, Rachel met her husband here. They went through the whole hierarchy of Tahoe housing, starting out with like a ski lease packed with people. Then they moved to a dingy apartment with orange shag carpet. A lot of the housing here in Tahoe is pretty outdated. And then they ended up finding, I think it's a 3-bedroom home on the North Shore of Tahoe. They have two young daughters. For a while, Rachel's mother or grandmother was also living with them. I think they were paying just over $2,000 a month in rent. And, you know, during the pandemic, I think they actually had wanted to leave their house before the pandemic to find a cheaper rent. But with the pandemic, they ended up staying another year. And then their lease was coming up to end on April 1st, and they were getting pretty anxious about that because, I mean, they can see what everyone up here sees and that there's just no places to rent. So if you are going to be out on the rental market, you need to be looking heavily in advance. They didn't get notice until very last minute. And when they did, when their landlord did tell them that they needed to be out, I think it was huge panic. I think, you know, the way Rachel described it to me, that is just like this emotional experience of dread and despair. And she was on every single website. She went to Craigslist, she went to Zillow, she went to Facebook, and just to try to find everything. But all that she found, I mean, she told me that the houses that she saw on Craigslist were between $5,000 to $8,000 a month for what
considerably.
They were renting.
It's more than double what they're paying monthly.
It's huge. It's a huge jump. It's, you know, it's way more than they can afford. And, you know, they have good jobs for Tahoe. She works for the hospital and her husband is a contractor who's been very busy because the demand for building right now is very high. And yet, like, they make too much money to qualify for the affordable housing that does exist in Tahoe, which is limited, but they don't make enough money to pay twice as much in rent. And they're kind of in this really tight spot. So they were, you know, looking at houses down in Reno, which is where a lot of people end up because it's quite a bit cheaper in Reno, even though it's still expensive. And that would mean that they would have to leave their community, change the schools for their children.
And a longer commute.
And can drive about an hour at least to work in a lot of cases. So, and stories like that are what we're seeing on Facebook on a near daily basis.
And I would imagine when it comes to the Brigham family, they work in town. So when you're talking about housing and long-term rentals, there are ripple effects to that. So what happens to a community and local businesses when the long-term rental market is so strained as it is right now?
Yeah, I mean, every single business I speak to is dealing with this right now. It's near impossible to find local workers, especially kind of that entry level new worker. It's so expensive for people to live in Tahoe. And I think the last fall that when I checked, the inventory for rentals was between 0% and 2%. I think it's gotten even worse since then. So there's just no ability for people to live locally, to work locally. So people are hiring out of the area, which means that people are commuting to Tahoe to work. And that in Tahoe, you know, the roads in Tahoe are pretty, especially in the winter, that's a tough commute. And you deal with chain control and snowstorms, and that doesn't always work out as well. It's just like there's a lot of traffic and it's a huge distance. So a lot of times, you know, when people hire out of town, it doesn't work out long term. I think what's also really interesting is that, you know, the housing crisis has been around for a long time in Tahoe, but now, this winter, I've spoken with several business owners who've told me that it's impacting their very long-term staff who've been with them forever, who've had stable housing homes they've been renting for years and years. And now those homes are selling from underneath them, leaving them in the same situation as the Brighams, having to scramble to find housing in a place where there really are no rentals available to rent long-term.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Julie Brown, a freelance journalist and contributing editor for SF Gate, where she covers Lake Tahoe. She is also a Tahoe local and currently lives in Reno. When it comes to solutions and resources, what resources are available for people, for locals looking for housing? Is really social media the best option, a friend of a friend, and kind of that game of telephone of trying to find a place? Or are there actual resources in place within the area to help individuals that are struggling?
Yeah, that's a great question. Housing is a huge priority for every single official up in Tahoe. It's very well known and everybody is working really hard to try to solve this problem. One of the best resources for people in the short term is this group called Landing Locals. And they, I like to think of them as like a matchmaker between long-term local employees who are looking for homes to rent and second homes. So Tahoe, you know, the vast majority of homes in Tahoe are second homes. And a lot of times those second homes are empty. Less so this year because so many second homeowners have moved permanently or indefinitely to their second homes. But still, there are still quite a few second homes that are sitting vacant while locals are scrambling to find places to live. And so Landing Locals saw that and is trying to solve that problem. So they have about a database of over 400 families and households who are actively looking for housing right now. That's like about 1,000 people when you add the size of the households. And about of those, about 44% are displaced because their current rental is being sold or their lease ended, which usually means the landlord wants their house back for some reason. And so even with Landing Locals, the inventory of available rentals is very few. Like it's been hard for them to place families. I mean, last year they did have a decent amount of success. They placed 75 rentals and it looks like they're on track to double that this year. But it's been a huge challenge for them and they've been really on the front lines of helping families find places to live and rent in Tahoe. Otherwise, you know, there's definitely a lot of effort underway to like, you know, figure out how to build more affordable housing, more workforce housing. Truckee has been doing tremendous work on this. A lot of that is available for people who are at the very, you know, low income, and a lot of the workers in Tahoe make too much to qualify for that affordable housing. So the available affordable housing doesn't quite help families like the Brighams.
Right. It's like a tough middle spot.
It's the missing middle is what they call it. Like, so Landing Locals is kind of like the only organization that's really addressing this short-term immediate crisis. Otherwise, that's why people are going to Facebook. I mean, Tahoe is such a tight, small community that, and these people who are looking for housing are so established in the community. They have a lot of people looking out for them. And I think, you know, these community groups on Facebook are just the way that they're able to cast the widest net to find housing, find places to live. And actually the Brighams, she posted, I think it was called The Bad Moms of Truckee, and that actually came through for her. Yeah, she woke up one morning and was tagged by a ton of her friends, alerting her to a tiny little house, smaller than the one they're in, but still close, and it was for about the same price they were paying, and they were able to find that house and secure that house. So there is hope. And they were able to find a place to live, but it was really stressful, and they were really lucky.
Julie Brown is a freelance journalist and contributing editor for SF Gate, where she covers Lake Tahoe. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and here at CAP Radio, we are quite excited. We're celebrating with some special programming all month long, and we have just the right person to guide us through all of that fun. Andrew Mills is with us today. He is CAP Radio's jazz host. Thank you so much for joining us today, and you're an inaugural guest here on Insight, correct?
That's right, Vicky. I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, let's start off with Jazz Appreciation Month. How did it get its start?
Well, Jazz Appreciation Month is more affectionately referred to as JAM, and it was created at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in 2001, so 20 years going now. And to celebrate jazz as a living music and also a historic music, which it is.
Well, when it comes to jam, I know that Cap Radio has a lot planned for the month. So what are y'all doing to celebrate?
Yeah, we have a lot of special programming on Cap Radio's Excellence in Jazz pretty much actually every night in April, including every Sunday evening in April starting at 9 p.m., where I'm presenting highlights from Blue Note Records. And if you don't know Blue Note, it's probably the most storied label in jazz history. There's really no question about that. There are other great labels, of course, like Verve and Prestige, but just the sheer volume of albums released on Blue Note, particularly in the 50s and 60s, that are widely regarded as timeless classics, it's really astonishing. And it's impossible to cover it all. And I could go on for hours about all the great records that came out just in 1963 alone, let alone the rest of the decade and, you know, everything coming out today.
Well, let's start listening to some jazz. What do you have looking for? What can we look forward to this weekend on Sunday?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll be highlighting some of the guitar players that have recorded for Blue Note over the years, most notably Kenny Burrell, who's a very famous guitar player, has a large catalog, but his most famous stuff comes on the Blue Note label. And this clip you're about to hear, it comes from his album Midnight Blue. It's the title track, actually. And it was released in 1963, which is right in the heart of Blue Note's golden age or golden era, which is a decade from about the late 50s to the late 60s. And this tune swings for sure, but you'll also hear some heavy elements of blues and R&B, kind of reminiscent of B.B. King or T-Bone Walker. And it's a really excellent example of the soul jazz sound that Blue Note is so famous for. So let's hear it.
Dance to that. I'd play that on a Friday after work.
Absolutely. I was bopping along right here at my dining room table. But yeah, so that's a classic record from Kenny Burrell. But we're also going to be featuring some newer music, guitar music specifically, this Sunday. And you'll hear this tune from Bill Frisell, who's been an active guitar player on the scene since about the early 80s. But what you're going to hear now, it was released just last year on his Blue Note album, Valentine. And I think you'll notice it sounds quite a bit different than the Burrell clip. He plays with a lot of different textures and sounds that are quite unique to the guitar. And then wait for about 40 seconds in, it becomes very melodic and it's just delightful.
Absolutely sounds almost more like experimental. And you mentioned that this was released just last year. Is that indicative of just kind of the evolution of jazz, given that this was more modern than the previous song that we heard?
Yeah, for sure. And it's also Bill Frisell's sound, but it's definitely the whole label, everything on the on the Blue Note label has changed over the years. And when you, if you explore the catalog more, you start to hear that more and more. So absolutely. And yeah, you can hear both of those tunes in full, plus a lot more from the Blue Note label this Sunday on Excellence in Jazz. And that special starts at 9 p.m. But also check out capradio.org/jazz. And you'll find a playlist I put together there of some newer Blue Note releases, including a track from an upcoming album by another fine, very fine guitarist. He comes from the Bay Area. His name is Julian Lodge.
Yeah, what I also love is that for Jam, Jazz Appreciation Month, Cap Radio, we're also taking a look back at some of the many concerts that Cap Radio has produced and recorded over the past 40 years, especially after the past year and having that kind of drought of live performances. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's just that. Cap Radio has produced lots of local concerts and recorded them live broadcasts over the last 40 years. And our jazz director, Gary Vercelli, has been there for every single one of them, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And we've got a clip here now that you can hear tonight on Excellence in Jazz, actually, with Avery Jeffrey. And I'm pretty sure you'll know this song, but it was performed in 2001 by a vocalist. Her name is Sandy Cressman. And this was at the Waterfront Park in Old Sacramento.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço, caminho do mar.
We're ending it quickly just because I know you have one more song and I really want you to share it. But this was The Girl from Ipanema, correct?
Yes, very famous song, Brazilian tune, known the world over, a big hit back in the 60s. But this next one we have coming up, it's from that same concert from a Bay Area guitarist named Ray Obiedo and his band. And it also features a fine percussionist by the name of Pete Escovedo. So let's check that out.
I think that's the perfect way to end the week at Insight. Thank you so much for sharing all of this music and just looking forward to continuing listening for Jazz Appreciation Month. Cap Radio Jazz host Andrew Mills, and look forward to the summer concerts.
Yeah, that's a cool thing that our midday classical host Jennifer Reason is heading that up. It's just a virtual concert series in the garden, and it's to kick off the first week of summer. It's going to air for 6 straight weeks every Friday at noon, and the concert videos will also be available to watch online, featuring a very diverse lineup of all local musicians and ensembles. So look forward to that from Jennifer Reason.
Well, that is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll catch you on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.